Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
What most people think. Lockdown.
Right, hello and welcome to episode 83 of What Most People Think. And I hope you're enjoying The new freedoms to do the thing that you're already doing. You're free to do the stuff that you'd already independently decided was reasonable in the first place. And obviously, you know, we get these freedoms because the vaccination is rolling out and it continues to roll out. All we need to do now is vaccinate the over 80s, over 70s, over 50s, children, garden gnomes, the ghost of Orson Welles, and possibly the ghost of Jill Dando. I just threw that one in there. And I've just appalled Simon Evans already there. I've got Simon Evans back on the show. As you know, people coming back to the show for a third time are now officially co-hosts. Welcome back to the show, Simon.
Thank you very much. I'm very encouraged and pleased to hear about my improved status.
Well, it's part of a cast. I think there are certain people that are guests, but I'd like to think that there are. Well, certainly anybody on the WhatsApp group, you know, is now an official cast member. I hope you're sort of enjoying the as we speak. It's I always sort of date check it. We're recording this on Wednesday, just coming up to lunchtime, and then we've had a tweet from Health Secretary Matt Hancock telling us to enjoy the sun. I don't know about you, but what point did he become like a hesitant stepdad to the nation? It's very strange. I mean, I suppose, like, if the people are coming to their political awareness around now, like the idea of politicians speaking to us in this way is all that they've known. But it is fucking weird, isn't it? That you sort of thought, oh, you know, set policies, you know, be involved in the creations of laws. But them having advice on barbecues, that's new, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose we've been smothered and suffocated to the extent that they are just sort of shouting under the duvet now. Make sure you don't get tangled under there, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, they're just bringing out plates of Marmite sandwiches and warm cocoa for us now, basically, aren't they? We've been so utterly infantilized.
It's beyond the nanny state, isn't it? It's the stepdad state, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
It's someone who has come into your life that doesn't really have like an official. It can work very well as a relationship. I had a great stepdad myself, but it's still a difficult one, isn't it? Because they don't have an official mandate.
No, you feel you don't sort of recognise any genetic affinity with Matt Hancock, and then here he is sort of advising
sure
you to get through your adolescence. I don't know. I mean, I find it slightly sinister because my suspicion is that they are up. You can have one of two dystopias. Either this is all our government does now, basically. It's like a series of sort of like health centre leaflets and pastel shaded posters. Or that's to distract us while they do go off and consult with the World Economic Forum about the Great Reset. You know, you've got those two options. And it's like neither of them are very sort of reassuring.
No, you're right. I've been suckered into the being annoyed about sort of very parochial advice, when actually I really should be annoyed about the fact they seem to have completely flipped their position on vaccine passports.
Yeah. What is interesting, though, and I mean, I've been on loads of these sort of podcasts where we talk about it, and I tend to end up with like-minded people, but we represent a tiny minority, you know, in the country now. You know, it's extraordinary how popular their whole... And because the vaccine rollout has been a tremendous success, which on its own terms it has, regardless of how you feel about having a vaccine for this thing, it's had a retroactive effect on the perception of how well they've handled everything. everything. You know, their general status and ranking is shot up. I saw a really quite sort of explicit graph yesterday that demonstrated that since October, their public approval of how they have handled everything has improved by at least a third, you know, on about 7 or 8 different metrics of how well you handle the old people, how well you handle furlough, how well you handled the policing of the situation. It's all gone up by sort of between a third and 50%. It's extraordinary, you know. That's how public perception is handled.
But I think it's also, we're very short-termist at the moment. That's one thing. I also think that the vaccine, for me, always felt like it was going to be, you know, those Ashes Down Under tours where England would go to Australia. We're going to get, this is before we started getting whitewashed when weirdly we've got a better team, but we used to have 3-1s. We always used to be 3-1. And there was like a really strong sense that if you could just win the last test match, it really, you got on that plane, buoyed up. And I think that what England have done.
I'll give you an even more brutal example. That I read a book a while ago which proved that when people have a medical procedure, the thing that they remember, the only thing that they remember is the peak experience, like how painful it got at its worst, and also, and significantly as a mitigating factor, how it was at the end, how it ended, how the whole process ended. And if the whole process ends quite painlessly, then they tend to put in their on their form afterwards that they found the whole thing was fine, even though at one point they were in agony, if the last half an hour was fine. So now, if, for instance, they give you a prostate examination with one of those sort of, you know, cameras on the end of an optical fiber type jobby, that going in, that's quite painful and discomforting. Then they leave it there pointlessly for half an hour, just so that the last half hour of your procedure, which is utterly redundant and serves no medical purpose whatsoever, except to make you feel that that was part of the procedure. And that has been, because that's relatively comfortable, your whole memory of how comfortable the whole experience was is adjusted upwards, even though all they've done is extend it by a meaningless half hour.
Well, it's a bit like comedy, isn't it? Like open well, finish well. I mean, I don't know about you, but you do gigs. There's such a disproportionate pressure on the last gig, on the last gag that you do, where it just feels like sex that ends weirdly, doesn't it? If the last gig, that was good for quite a while, and then it just ended strangely. So maybe they factored all in. Maybe they were just sort of phoning it in, and they just thought, look, as long as we get the vaccine right.
As long as we come on the nation's tits at the end, it'll be fine.
Right, with that profanity, it brings me neatly to the cuss count, which is, I don't know if this is a new thing since you were last on, but we sort of were tracking the curve of swearing in the same way that Chris Whitty might track incidences of a virus. So I had a solo episode last week, and it was a basic 17 fuckings, 4 fucks, 2 shithouseries, which is, I like that swear word, 2 arseholes and 2 shits, which is 0.7 swears a minute. But you're on the, we've got a leaderboard as well, Simon. And so there's 28 people on it. Where would you imagine that you're sort of coming swears wise?
What, on your podcasts? On your podcast, but I'm not a big swearer, I don't think. The occasional sort of punctuation, but I would think I was in the bottom third, I would have thought.
Yeah, you're coming at two episodes, 1 swear, so 0.5. Oof. Yeah, it's low.
Do you remember what it was?
I
didn't bother it.
I don't know. I think it was something Chaucerian, but...
Dash it all.
But it's up to you. You could either kind of keep up that sort of proud record of not needing to swear, or you could realise that it is actually big and clever.
Well, I think the whole point of swearing, isn't it, is that it's an attempt to be offensive among people with a limited vocabulary. I've always encouraged my children to think this. I've no problem with being offensive, but just be creative with it, you know. And it's of course, there are far, far more offensive words available to us now, an ever-increasing stock.
Yeah, offensive portmanteau swear words as well.
Yeah, that's true. Well, those are just horribly twee, aren't they? The cock womble sort of.
They do work, though. No, I agree. I like shithousery. I think
that's a good one. Yeah, but that feels like a builder's portmanteau, doesn't it? Rather than
someone said utter shithousery. I just feel like it really specifically. There's a really brilliant Twitter account called Cricket Shithousery, and it's just the lowest. And there's something really funny about a sport that's supposed to be sort of noble, and anyone who loves the sport will know that it's anything but.
What does it mean, though, shithouse? Is it just mean I have no time for this, or is it...
Shithousery would be kind of like acting like an arsehole, I suppose. Right. Just kind of...
Jackanapes.
Low-level Machiavellian behaviour, I think.
Ah, right, okay.
That's my own.
Cynical, right, yeah. Pakistani ball tampering, basically, is what you're talking about, right?
Well, we have to now say that not just Pakistani ball tampering. Well, the most recent example... obviously was white people, Simon, actually.
Was that the Australian, wasn't it?
Yeah, with the sandpaper. Yeah.
And he was in tears at the press conference. It was hilarious. Nothing,
I mean, look, I'm going to say it, and this is really unevolved, but I love seeing men cry in public. I think it's fucking...
Yeah, it's
a good laugh, isn't
sorry,
it?
I've let everyone down.
Yeah. Fantastic. We have new patrons this week. New patrons. We've got Connor D. Sounds like a rapper. Michael Smith. I mean, the great thing about when you get the surname Smith, you always think that their parents must think, okay, this is one of the most common surnames in Britain. I would always tend to think he needs an exotic first name, but they've gone Michael Smith. They didn't want him to stand out. They didn't want him to be noticed.
No, the thing about Smith is, you're right, Michael Smith is very boring, but if you have an exotic first name, it immediately becomes fully film star, doesn't it? You know, if you go Mohammed Smith, that's like instantly interesting.
No. We also got Alex Mungovan. I mean, it's not a pretty name, Alex. I mean, and also, by the way, patrons, be well aware, they're paying me money and I do generally insult their names. Mungovan does sound like a Hungarian insult, doesn't it?
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah, I don't know what it means. I mean, it might just be like
Mungovan,
a...
How dare you go?
It's like a substandard kebab van, just one you wouldn't trust, maybe.
The patrons, the subjects we're going to get through today, we're going to be talking about the teacher in Batley that showed the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. We'll also be looking at a school. So it's both about schools this week that has... Well, I'll tell you in a while. I don't want to trigger you. It's one of the most annoying news stories I've read in some time. But also, we're going to hopefully get to some letters for Simon at the end. And the letters come from the VIP patrons. When we get guests back, the VIP patrons have first dibs on the letters. So there'll be a few of those. But before we get into the subject, Simon, just a quick thank you and a fuck you. Is there something you are grateful for and something you are really pissed off about this week?
Yeah, I am. I'm actually quite grateful historically. In fact, this ties in, although I didn't intend it to, with what I was saying earlier about swearing. I've been reading a book. I'm doing a sort of a book review for The Spectator every so often at the moment, and I sort of collate them into by theme. And I'm doing sort of history of conservative and right wing thought to find out where it lost its way. And I've been reading about some of the great historical conservative figures, and it is so bracing to hear people expressing conservative ideas without any kind of apologetic undertones, you know, the way that the kind of like ameliorating, logic chopping, sort of like minced version of the thought that you get nowadays from supposedly conservative government. People like, if you want to look at the book called The Conservative Mind by Russell Kirk, is a great history of conservative thinkers from Edmund Burke onwards. And John Randolph of Roanoke, who was a sort of Southern senator in about the 1810s, around that time. John C. Calhoun, people like this, fantastic, staunch defense of conservative principles, completely unapologetic acknowledgement that men are not born equal and are not to be considered equal to one another. So you wouldn't hear that on either side of the chamber now. So I'm very grateful to, I suppose, the persistence of the written word.
Yeah, I mean, that idea of just simply acknowledging that people are born with different sort of talents and ability.
It
sounds radical now, doesn't it? But I mean, it's like we all fucking know deep down that's how it is.
If you don't acknowledge it, then the whole idea of conservative politics falls apart. The idea of like trying to maintain any kind of rightist principle without acknowledging that simple fact is just absurd. It's cruel and incoherent, but nobody's willing to acknowledge it anymore. It's bizarre, even though it's the heart of all folk wisdom and drama and everything that's ever been written or
I mean, I just think in people's families as well. This is, I often think this about tough love. A lot of people who identify as against tough love,
yeah,
if you brought it down to a localized level and their friends and family, they'd have all exercised it at some point. And similarly, if you spoke about innate abilities on a family level, everyone would be able to tell you who had which innate ability. But somehow, the moment you scale that up outside their fucking immediate postcode, it's problematic.
It's so true. I do think this is one of the things people say, you go right, you drift right wing after parenthood. And a lot of people, I think, put that down to the idea that you want to protect your children from society. So you become a bit more of a law and order enthusiast, you know. Yeah. But I think it's much more no blank slate view of the world can survive the second child. You know, the idea that they come into the world as this kind of thing you can form and create and sort of like, you're lucky if you can get them to sort of grow even remotely vertically, you know. It's like they're such gnarly little buggers. And that's great, you know. God, can you imagine how dismal the world would be if actually, you know, the blank slate view of the things was accurate and correct?
No, it's too much pressure. In many ways, that idea is massively reassuring to anybody who's having a kid. Yes. There's only so much you can do.
Absolutely right. Yeah, it really is, actually. It's like, well, you should have five or six, because nothing you can do to them will make any difference anyway. So you might as well just let them swarm.
A dartboard. Yeah. And a fuck you. What is something that's kind of gnarled you this week?
A fuck you. This would go to legacy media, especially in America, who have been attacking. There's a sort of dispute, a row going on between especially New York Times reporters and various Substack writers. Do you know Substack? It's a bit like your, I don't know what method you use for having patrons like Patreon or whatever, but Substack is a process by which writers can have their own fan base, very much like comedians do, and you sign up for it and you can have different sort of levels of commitment. And it's created a real tension with like the New York Times, Washington Post media, who don't like it at all. And there's this kind of, there are all kinds of attempts to delegitimize it, undermine it, to create sort of scandals where none exist, you know, to say that Substack is going to become some sort of hive of alt-right thinking. You know, these are people like, I don't know, Andrew Sullivan, I don't know if you know him, Barry Weiss and Glenn Greenwald. And, you know, these are people who've been very much on the liberal sort of side of things, but they're now creating really interesting, proper old school investigative journalistic content, you know, unhampered by the sort of canteen politics of the big newspaper.
And it's sort of unsettled the establishment journalist then?
Massively, it seems so. There's a guy, a philosopher, I don't know if you know him, his Twitter handle is Outsideness, his name is Nick Land. Funny enough, he used to teach my wife philosophy at Warwick University, but he lives in Shanghai now, and he says in just 1 year, Substack has become the whole of the credible media scape. So that's that's his view. So that's expressing it a bit strongly, but I would certainly sooner read any of them over what comes out. I've just found, I mean, it's been interesting, you know, the era of Trump, because obviously Trump was full of shit from beginning to end, you know, in many important regards, and a lot of his talk about fake news and his claims about the attendance at his inauguration, all the rest of it, that was all crap. But it certainly did, I think, expose, you know, extraordinary degrees of bias and motivated thinking within the liberal press as well. And I find it really hard to trust a word they say now.
Well, I've thought for a while that one of my issues with the liberal left is that they just don't want anything to change. If you look at any of the big ticket sort of continuity global order things, that they don't want anything to change, whether it's the World Health Organization, the Paris Accord, Brexit. And you think, all right, fair enough, individually you can make strong arguments for all these things, but you just think there'd be one subject where they'd want to shake things up a bit. And it turns out they probably still got Blockbuster Video memberships, probably, you know, they're probably still sticking with that. And
it's weird in that regard, you're right. And yet at the same time, of course, they are also those people, they are also like extraordinarily progressive in the sense that they're happy to do away with things that have sort of, you know, that they cannot see the immediate purpose of. But that the conservative mindset might say, well, actually, you know, those might be traditional responses to long-term chronic issues.
Yeah.
You know?
Culturally quite radical, but sort of in terms of political institutions, just absolute old farts. Right, we're going to crack on with the first subject here, and we're going to be talking about the RS teacher from Batley. Was it grammar school? Batley Grammar School.
It is a grammar school, apparently, which is not an aspect of it that's been investigated enough, I think, but there we are.
Okay, so this story about the religious studies teacher in Batley, I missed it on last week's podcast because I posted early, and apparently that freaks some of you out. You then think that Wednesday is fucking Thursday or something. But there was, if you listen to this outside the UK and you haven't caught up with this story, there was an RS teacher at a grammar school in Batley, which is in Yorkshire, is that right, Simon?
Yeah,
be in Yorkshire. And he showed images of the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad to 13 to 14-year-old students. There was a backlash from some angry parents, and
maybe 20.
And he was promptly suspended, pending gross misconduct charges. I think that's what they've leveled against him. And I suppose, like, you know, the first thing is we don't have blasphemy laws in the UK. And this does bring up this problem that's happened before, is this clash between certain religious principles and the actual rule of law in this country. I mean, I don't really know what the legal basis is that the school think they have for suspending him.
No, it's an ad hoc and sort of contingency response, isn't it? I think it's an attempt to kind of calm the situation down and take the heat out of it, but I think it's badly misguided. I think it's a terrible precedent they've set. I can't believe that they can imagine that this is going to mollify anyone. Every experience, every, you know, encounter that we have had in this country and across the West with religious bigotry over the last 20 or 30 years, you could argue over hundreds of years, but certainly this particular flavor of it, where there's been any attempt to kind of mollify and to reach out and to meet halfway and so on, has done nothing but reassure the bigots, the bullies, the, you know, those threatening violent retributions that their tactics work and that they will come out that much more quickly and that much more with that much more alacrity next time. You know, it's a terrible precedent to set. They should have set their stall out very, very clearly early on. The teachers' union should have come very clearly and unambiguously to his aid, which they've been, as far as I can tell so far.
The unions have just been incredible. If you look at how opinionated they've been over the last year in particular, you know, and certainly when it comes to teacher safety, there's a couple of unions that it was proved that they had plenty to say about the way that the Sarah Everard vigil was policed, fucking nothing to do with them in particular. Yeah. And then, at this moment where it comes up, like there is, a specific, I think, like in terms of whether or not they've been a direct threat on this man's life, there's certainly a fear which is completely understandable, given that not so long ago, in a country very close to us, France, a teacher was beheaded for doing the same thing. So even if the threat hasn't been direct yet, you can understand the anxiety. And yet the unions are just, let's just be cool. Let's just wait to see what happens. So it's the same union that were like, no, let's keep the schools shut and let's not see how infections work in the vaccinated age. I mean, the hypocrisy stinks.
I completely agree with you. I mean, it's not a new observation that unions are essentially a sort of, you know, a paramilitary branch of the Labour Party or of socialist politics generally and involve themselves where those issues match up closely to their main agenda, but this is a very clear-cut case where a union member or where a teacher needs support and where they need to encourage people to believe that they can teach freely, and they've completely failed. I think it's a very, very dangerous moment in British history, because you quite correctly draw the comparison with this teacher who was beheaded in France. It reminds me, without being sort of, I don't think this is scaremongering, reminds me very much of how we watched in horror but kind of like a kind of appalled fascination as the virus, you know, swept through Northern Italy about, you know, just over a year ago, and still had that feeling that the English Channel would somehow protect us from this. That there was no way it could cross here.
I thought like the stiff upper lip would act like a form of PPE.
Yeah. We think we have firewalls in place. We think we're protected. You know, there is, and I'm kind of a fan of British exceptionalism in some regards, because quite often it really does work. And quite often, if you do just act like these things don't matter and don't count and won't affect us, they don't. Yeah. But, you know, we have to be very clear that this is France is a few years further down the road in terms of militant Islamism and its attempts, you know, and they are obviously, they have taken stronger measures than have ever been deemed necessary in this country. They have a much stronger, more vocal debate constantly ongoing about burqas and so on. You know, because it's been a longer problem. We shouldn't pretend that can't happen here, that we can't get into that situation. And it's something I think we need to be extraordinarily clear. And it's going to take a certain amount of courage to do that.
And you know, something that really annoyed me was that press conference that was given. Well, I don't even know if they were parents, but they were Muslim representatives from the area. And the way that they tried to ramp up the rhetoric and broaden it. So it wasn't just that, you know, these cartoons have been shown, which obviously is going to be, you know, you can understand that will cause offence, whether or not that means that the teacher shouldn't do it is another issue. But then they started bringing in your children's safety is at risk. And there were these coded allusions to being taught about same-sex marriages. And I just thought it was a strangely British moment where I just thought, you know what? No one is going to stop my son being taught about gays, right?
It's weird how that's become like the agreed point, isn't it? It's like that old Schwarzenegger hand handshake thing from, you know, that meme from the movies. Like, we agree on the hard left and the hard right.
We agree
that the right to teach gay sex in religious education.
Teach it. But then also the right do have a tipping point. Well, I saw a brilliant article by Joanna Rossiter in The Spectator whereby, you know, there were we've had lessons where kids have been taught about drag and 11-year-olds were asked to research and revise hardcore porn, right?
So it's
strange where the left tend to draw this line. And I suppose, like in so many cases, is that this pathological fear of seeming even like vaguely racist means that the left often take refuge in arguments and make fuck all sense.
Well, the safety issue is the big thing, and you're absolutely right. This has become like the key weapon to use in any attempt to get your own way, like in what is generally termed, you know, social justice movements or whatever. Yeah. I think the trans movement may have like really, I don't know whether it was like a trial and error thing when they suddenly found safety. That unlocks the door. Suddenly you're in. As soon as you say you're putting trans lives at risk, as soon as you're saying you're putting trans children at risk, as soon as you claim that safety is, there's two things. You either claim it's a safety issue or that you're denying someone's right to exist by your rhetoric is trying to erase their existence entirely. And, you know, maybe that, I mean, in a way it would have made more sense to say we erase, you know, the prophet's existence. But yeah, as soon as they say you're putting children's lives at risk, in a society such as it is now, as we've seen, obviously, with the pandemic, then, you know, it just utterly extinguishes and smothers any other kind of debate or line of attack.
And I think you're right in a way to situate this, because I think that there is a danger, certainly when I see certain people who certainly come across as a bit racist, is they see this as a very different thing to everything else that's happening. Whereas I see these parents as part of everything that's happening, which is part of cancel culture. It's part of confirmation bias, intellectual narcissism.
It's part very much of what I was talking about earlier with the newspapers, the way in which the New York Times try and protect their journalists from any sort of criticism from Substack writers or anybody else is by saying it's a safety issue. You're harassing our journalist.
Yeah.
You say such and such a journalist is talking shit and this article is crap and it's poorly researched and it's biased. Mm. And they go, you're harassing our journalists. You're putting journalists' lives at risk. You know, journalists live in fear. You know, and then, I mean, somebody posted yesterday a table of the top 25 jobs in terms of the dangers that they present, you know, from working on an oil rig, you know, down to working A&E on a Friday night. Funnily enough, journalism wasn't in there, you know. It's actually a relatively safe way to earn. I mean, you're certainly unlikely to face redundancy, but in terms of actually on the job safety. So, yeah, but they have found it. Safety is like that's become kryptonite to anyone who wants to maintain a sort of anti-fragile society. My view on Islam, I read there's a great piece called When Islam Breaks Down by Theodore Dalrymple. It's about 10 years old now, I think, but it's still online. It's worth reading, where he says that the thing is that you can sort of understand their position insofar as the Anglican Church, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago began a sort of modernizing campaign and started to include, you know, gay, you know, trendy vicars and allow gay bishops and so on. And however much more inclusive it is, it's utterly lost its power, hasn't it? It's lost its authority. It's lost
its shape.
It's lost integrity. It's never enough. You know, the slippery slope is real in this regard. And Islam wants nothing to do with that. They don't want any lines to be crossed. They want no breach of the ramparts. You know, it's a totally zero tolerance approach. Islam is as unblemished in its principles as it was in 680 AD or whatever. They probably don't appreciate AD as a way of dating it, but yeah, let's say common era. But the determination to maintain the purity of the thing, you know, there are some very unpleasant images of purity which are described as the differences between men and women within Islam. I've seen this discussed, you know, that a boy who loses his virginity is like a handkerchief that is dropped in the gutter but can be picked up again, but a girl is, that's like a flower that's been dropped in the gutter, that's gone now. I think they think of Islam itself as like the flower, you know. It cannot endure any kind of besmirchment. It has to be kept pure and clean, and that when that encounters, you know, the generally sort of pluralist attitudes of Western democracy, that's a really tricky one to unpick. You know, we live alongside each other and pretend that the issue doesn't exist. But when it does exist, there's a total impasse.
I mean, let's be like, you know, people might think that we would have a take on this that they could sort of anticipate. I mean, let's go straight the other way. Showing that cartoon to 13 to 14 year old kids, I mean, like on a person by person basis, is there an argument that he could have just gone, maybe a shit idea? Maybe.
Yeah, well, it probably is. I mean, I've never, like, I mean, his job has obviously been on a day-to-day, you know, encounters with that community. He must have had some idea of how it was likely to play out one way or another, and presumably got it wrong, because I can't imagine that this was his end game, you know. Occasionally, you do see people in the press in these kind of situations who seem to have quite a substantial response already. Like, do you know what I mean? Like when Lawrence Fox, who I don't know, and I've no particular beef with him one way or the other, but when he went on Question Time, I don't think I'd ever heard of him. You know, suddenly it sort of all flares up over a couple of odd interactions, and now he's running for mayor, you know, a year later. And it sort of feels like that was, in hindsight, that a bit like Piers Morgan storming off Breakfast Time. You know, you think, well, that's just a more dramatic way.
Well,
of saying,
I did think with the Piers Morgan storm off, storming off is often really quite a messy thing. You know, we've seen many, often when you're on telly, you have wires attached to you. The fact that he just, it was a clean walk to the exit suggested to me that
it
that
was World Wrestling Federation, wasn't it? I'm sorry, I've had enough of this on the Tonight programme. Yeah. But I don't think this teacher is one of those. That's my point. I don't think he's one of those guys who thought, I want to create, even possibly that Eton teacher, I don't know for sure. I watched his video, I thought it was a really interesting case, but at least there I could see arguments for and against, you know. I could see what was going on to some extent, that there was a dispute. I don't think this guy is in that situation at all. And, you know, it is kind of heartbreaking hearing his father say, you know, his life is over, you know. And I don't know whether that's, I mean, I would be amazed if that was some kind of dramatic script that they've written and cooked up between them to try and get up sympathy. I think he really feels that. I think he feels unsafe living in his hometown, you know. And even if it was a misjudgment, which I would say it wasn't a misjudgment, but maybe it could have been described verbally. The thing with cartoons is they have no sort of intrinsic artistic worth, you know, so you can probably use a couple of dozen sentences would describe the entire situation without needing to demonstrate the picture. I guess that would have been fine, you know.
But there is context here. I mean, he is a religious studies teacher, so there is a possible reason for him showing it. I mean, if this had been a PE teacher, going, hey, lads, do you want to see this? I mean, I do think that then
do you want to see my new tattoo of Muhammad I've had done on my ass?
I do think that then you're arguably in slightly different territory. I think when it comes to this story, I think what most people think, you know, I try to do this every once in a while, is name check.
And that's why it's in the line of duty.
Yes. It's the, you know, as a decision, it was a big shout, but it is, you just cannot cross this line where if people are angry or upset enough that you have concessions to the rule of law.
Yeah, I agree, because that's, if you leave it lying there, it's like they've chucked some kind of seeds over the land, over the line, and if you don't clear them up immediately, then they take root and that's the new line. You know, and this line now exists. The line has moved. You know, what they've achieved so far has been established as a consensus.
Let's be honest. I don't think, certainly for a while, that there'll be any other RS teachers who'll be showing any cartoons. So in a way, regardless of the outcome of the inquiry, it sort of worked. Okay, me and Simon are just going to hype a couple of our bits now here. I've got, as a launch event for my book on the 11th of May, my book, Where Did I Go Right? How the Left Lost Me, is an online event with an organisation called FANE, FANE, F-A-N-E, and it's Ramesh Ranganathan going to be interviewing me. That's on at 6:30. And I think there's a ticket whereby, like, if you want to watch the event and buy the book, the hardback book is like $16.99. I think the ticket is a tenner. The book is supposed to be 15 quid. So that seems like a decent deal. And there's also signed copies from Waterstones. You know, if you're one of these lefties, you don't want to give any money to Jeff fucking Bezos or whatever, is that there are signed copies, full price, but signed copies. You get a signed copy. I sat here doing them the other week, and it's the most sort of stress I've put on my wrist since adolescence. There you go, a wanking gag. And Simon, anything that I should be directing people towards for your good self?
My main thing at the moment is Common Sanity, which is my own podcast, which I've taken a lot longer to get off the ground, Jeff, than you have with yours. But we're doing them now. It's recorded at Il Portico Restaurant, and it's a collaboration with that in Kensington. And it's a sort of convivial long-form chat with two or three other people. We've got a couple couple up on Spotify and YouTube now. But if anyone enjoys hearing me talk, you know, then that's the place to do it. My other thing is my Patreon at the moment. Basically, if you want to come to find me on Twitter, the Simon Evans, the pinned tweet takes you there. And that's where I put all my written content at the moment. There's probably a book's worth on there. I should probably put it between our covers and bung it into Waterstones. But for the time being, you can sign up to that for a couple of quid a month or whatever. And that's keeping me ticking over. Touring again in earnest, I think starts in May. September is packed, and hopefully the autumn will be a chance to recoup.
It's nice, isn't it? We now have a diary of a notional future that we can look forward to. A hypothetical idea of what might happen. You know, just a sort of a pitch. This is, what's your pitch? Well, in September, you might be touring, Jeff. Yeah, I like that pitch. Let's work it up a little bit. Okay, this next story, trigger warning. Okay, it's just going to annoy the shit out of you if you haven't come across this already. I'm just going to follow the link. I'm just going to talk you through it. This is a story on BBC News. School almost eliminates bullying with break time ban on games. So a school claims to have almost eliminated bullying by banning games like football at break times. And the head teacher of the school, the Hackney New School, such a surprise that it would come from that bit of London, but says there have only been 5 reports of bullying this year because, well, they're not playing, they're not doing any fun stuff anymore. Rather than kicking a football around or jumping skipping ropes in the playground unsupervised, pupils practice sonnets by classic poets like Shelley and Tennyson, or quiz each other on Capital City. So what this head teacher has done is essentially made break time another lesson, and seems
another
to want
lesson, yeah,
fucking credit for it. You know, it's just like saying society almost eliminates car crashes with ban on cars, right? There's no car. Oh, look, we're down on car crashes. I'm starting to speak faster because I am fucking annoyed. And I do think, Simon, what we've done to kids, not just in this last year, but particularly in this last year, are they just going to form a militia and just shoot us all eventually? I'll just take it. I'll go, yeah, I understand why you feel this way. What is going on?
Arguably, that the whole danger is that they won't do that. The fear is that it actually works, that these methods and these approaches actually sap them of all their energy and their vigour, and they don't form militias and they don't fight back.
She want credit for it? She speaks as though she genuinely expects to get credit for this awful thing that she's done to kids. And she says, oh, well, there's no bullying now. Other than intellectual bullying, one of the things that some kids who aren't academic
basically
really good at football.
It's the same way they say there's no violence because the state has monopoly of violence, you know. And she's basically got monopoly of bullying, hasn't she? She is the bully. She's absorbed all the capacity for bullying into herself, and she's doing it by forcing kids who'd rather be playing football to learn poetry.
Yeah, and kids getting bullied for not knowing their metaphysical poets now. Look at me, Shelley, or I don't even know.
I mean, I've got to say, from my point of view, and probably we are slightly different, I'm projecting, but I was one of those kids who didn't particularly want to play football in break time. I used to sit in the canteen with my mate Ross, and we played chess on a little pegboard, you know, a little travel chess board I used to carry around. I probably might even, if there'd been a poetry society, I could quite easily have been one of those guys inside there learning poetry instead of playing football. But it's a choice, isn't it? It's an option. Yeah. I mean, that seems to be an extraordinarily important part of the calculation. Yeah. It's not saying, you know, banning football and giving kids an option to play read poetry if they would rather do that. Those are two very, very different, you know. But essentially, it is all of a piece with everything else we've said so far. It is the attitude to, you know, to lockdown. It's... I saw a little exchange on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. Toby Young, he posted some meme in which he was like, you know, if you give up your freedom, be careful. You know, you can be safe and you can be fed 3 times a day. Be careful what you wish for. And the picture was of a lion in a zoo cage and then a lion, you know, out on the savannah. And obviously the lion out in the savannah is threatened with starvation. You know, they die. They encounter other bigger lions that kill them and stuff. You know, it's a dangerous life. But, you know, which one do you want to live? And Adam Rutherford, a geneticist from UCL, posted this response saying that actually lions in the zoo live twice as long as lions in the wild, as if he hadn't realized that, you know, Young was aware of that, but was still saying you're willing to just sacrifice any kind of sense of dignity or kind of the ability
autonomy.
To Yeah, exactly. Where is that all going? Bullying is like, nobody likes that word bullying, but you know, the rough and tumble of school playground life is an important part of play. That is, bullying is basically where play crosses the line. Bullying is where you learn, you know, that you've, I mean, and I used to get punched more often than I inflicted pain on anyone else at school.
Me too, yeah.
And
too.
I learned valuable lessons. It was, don't try and use your fucking linguistic facility and fluency to ridicule a bloke who's 6 inches taller than you.
It's a good life lesson.
Really handy lesson, that.
One of the other things she said that really bugged me, I've read this story far too many times. She says, well, you often see kids aimlessly wandering the playground. We want every second at school to count. There's nothing wrong with aimlessly wandering the playground. Like, it's the same as like time when you're just not looking at your phone and you're looking at a wall. That is golden time. That's really important time when you just, where you defrag your fucking brain. And the idea,
this argument has been going around for centuries. There was a character in Dickens called Gradgrind who was like, it was like a Dickens mockery of the utilitarian sort of philosophy. What we want is facts. You know, we got no time for religion or poetry or yeah, as you say, staring out the window, you know, staring up at the sky. It's a really important part of any human process, you know, and the idea that you're going to be able to sustain that in the rest of your life. You need to learn how to use a certain amount of self-discipline in order to snap back into reality when you need to as well. To be just kept permanently on rails means you'll never learn how to use a road.
Yeah, just a kid just walking around, chatting to their mate aimlessly. One thing that people forget about schools, and it just used to occur to me a lot when I was a teacher, is that you're a teacher, you teach a single subject all day, so it's stressful. You're on your feet, but you roughly know what's going to happen. Kids will literally go drama, PE, history, maths. Their brain gets fucking knocked from left to right like a ship in a storm. And so we couldn't. I mean, if you think about like setting up a new laptop, I would set aside half a day just to do that currently.
I would think the single most useful skill anyone can have in the modern world is the ability to maintain focus on a task for at least 5 minutes until it's completed. Yeah. I mean, how often have you like sat in your kitchen, noticed that you need something which you normally order on Amazon, come back into your laptop to order it on Amazon, clicked open your screen, and there is something that distracts you, and you spend another 20 minutes and you leave the laptop and you go back in the kitchen, and go, oh, for God's sake, I forgot to order, you know, whatever it was. That's almost like, I would say, half of being an adult is the ability to not to stop that happening too much, to not be derailed too often. And you will never learn that ability if you've always got staff telling you, right, we're now going to do this, we're now going to do that. You never get to choose what you're going to do next, you know.
I honestly find it terrifying. And I think that just the fact that she, I mean, like, one thing I wonder, I suppose, is if my kid was out of school, would I confront the head teacher? Because one thing I'm learning, my kid's 5 now, and I always thought I'd be down there every week, you know, calling things out that I was sort of philosophically against. But then also you remember that your kid is the public face of you. So it's not a zero sum game. If you just go in there, you go, what the fuck are you doing? You're ruining these kids. But my son is the one that has to be there day in, day out.
Ours are totally like, oh, Dad, please. Well, Mum, please don't, you know, because I never threatened to go in. Mum, please don't. I mean, he absolutely mortified if she so much as threatened to go into the changing room and find his lost plimsoll, you know. You mustn't. You can't do that. You've got to make it a safeguarding issue again. That's how we do it. Somehow we've got to make it safeguarding. I don't know how you do it then.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Like so many examples, I've got to say that she is endangering children's mental health. Our children
but
are
she
in
is.
Danger.
She is. You've got to read, you may have read, The Coddling of the American Mind. Did you see this book? Came out about 4 years ago. Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, I think it's called. And it's about mental health crisis in universities, which they absolutely pin back to this kind of stuff. Kids have never been exposed to any kind of criticism or rough and tumble or Sturm und Drang at all in their earlier life, and they arrive at university and they're just not prepared for it. They're just not equipped to cope with the responsibilities of encountering the life in the raw, you know. And it's all, I mean, a lot of them, they said it's like partly it's demographics, because an awful lot of kids now are only children. And I'm an only child myself, so I know it was slightly different. But in the 70s, you know, it was a very different thing. You
that
weren't
was a
like
rare
protected
beast,
and weaponized.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was.
Do you remember? It was almost like a coded, it was almost like you know, you used to whisper the words cancer. They go, only child. Okay, so I think, look, I don't want to ever claim to have like a singular voice on a subject, but I honestly think what most people think on this is that it's fucking mental. This woman is a menace and she needs to be stopped. Okay, letters. We've got a few letters. So I put the shout out to the patrons, VIP patrons, that you're going to be on the show, Simon. This one's less a question, just more of an apology. This is from Matthew Chrisley. No question, but I do have a vague memory of drunkenly heckling Simon during a uni gig in Portsmouth in 02-03. Please apologise on my behalf.
Forgiven.
I'll be a bit, you see, dramatically, if you'd have rejected the apology there. Subjected to, you'll revisit. Simon
harassment.
Will revisit in 20 years. Yeah, you put him in harm's way. this is an interesting one from Michael Slee. Can you ask Simon if his view, any view of his, has shifted significantly in response to a media campaign or shitstorm? I suppose it's a more general point that we face, whether... I mean, I suppose I'll give you an example of where I've slightly moved the dial recently and I didn't expect it, was I watched the Meghan interview and I had a very negative view of them as a couple going into it. And I had a slightly less negative view of them at the end.
Like, I
felt there was slightly less dicks. What I suppose came out of that interview for me was I thought, actually, I do think that there is a real love there. And maybe I was a bit cynical about her motives to him. But yeah, I wondered if... I guess what he's saying is, do we ever really move the dial on our own opinions?
Yeah, it's a good question. On the Meghan one, I would agree with you. Having watched the interview, that did improve my view of them. But then I think that's just a natural human response. And I don't think it is necessarily what I should allow to, you know, in the same way that you're much more likely to hire the best candidate if you just look at the CVs than if you actually meet them face to face.
Really?
You know, because, that's a proven fact. And interviews tend to sort of muddy the waters, you know. And you know, they were very extraordinarily well-trained. Even Harry has learned a certain amount.
He has, hasn't he?
Capacity for maintaining. I mean, he's, oh God, love him. But anyway, he...
But did you see that bit where there was one moment where, a couple of moments where he went to speak and she did the hand on the knee to stop him talking? And naturally, Twitter really zeroed in on that. But I did think that is not unusual in any situation between...
No, it's not. It's like a parents' evening, wasn't it?
Yeah. Not yet. They've read what you're going to say. They've reviewed it and it's shit and they're going to carry on speaking. But yeah,
I think the way that media campaigns at the moment work, what it generally is that there's a moment where something is brought to my attention. I go, okay, that's interesting. I'll investigate it. And then I might make my own mind up about whether or not it's somebody's grifting or whether or not somebody has actually identified a serious problem. And so they have that impact and they have that capacity to make you aware of the problem. But I think most of us have a natural disposition towards things, you know. Mm. I think this is like an interesting aspect of politics that isn't discussed enough. And a lot of people nowadays talk in terms of heuristics and confirmation bias and all that kind of thing. But it's been known about for a long time. There was a guy, a conservative philosopher called Michael Oakeshott, who I think wrote the best thing about it about 50 years ago, talking about the conservative disposition as just basically being somebody who prefers the local to the global, who prefers the tried and tested to the experimental, and who prefers, as he put it, present laughter to future utopian bliss. You know, it's like, if that's your disposition, if that's what you just tend to be like emotionally, if that's where your mind settles naturally, that would inform most of the sort of social campaigns that you encounter.
Yeah.
And you'll decide whether or not there is some, whether or not basically there is a thorn in a toe that can be extracted relatively swiftly and without lots of unintended consequences, you know, or whether what you're trying to get to is such a fundamental reorganization of society that it's likely to bring about the second great terror, you know. And those are the two kind of, you know, poles, and you have to try and...
Yeah, no, I think one of my, there was an argument by, there was an article by Matthew Paris a while ago about, like, are you a conservative? If you are, you tend to think these things. And one of the key ones for me is that old one about taking on the world as it is, not as you wish it to be. And I'm definitely, you know, a pragmatist. And, you know, it comes to, and that applies to something like gender, where sort of people talk about the possibility of living in a completely gender fluid society. And I just think, I just whether or not all of it is scientifically proved, I look around me, I see so much evidence that this shit is way more baked in than we realise.
Absolutely. John Randolph of Roanoke, who I mentioned earlier, is one of my great sort of 19th century conservatives, gave a great speech in which he kicks off by sort of emphasizing the broken and irredeemable nature of man by reminding us that the firstborn was a murderer. You know, Cain, the first man born of woman, you know, not just cultivated out of the dry clay, was a murderer. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that's an historical fact. It's a mythical position, but it's one that recognises that means suggests that people recognise our fundamental nature. You know, the
or just the way that probability works. There's always going to be so many murderers. It just happened at the very first time.
It's unfortunate.
Like, if you've got took another 20,000 people before a murder was born, but it was just jolly bad luck that the first one out. what was a murderer, but you know, like Eve was Eve herself. She was a little bit like, I always thought there's something a bit Macbethy about, you know, there's a certain kind of wife that sort of cajoling her husband into making bad decisions, and just by bad chance, the very first woman was that as well, and also the very first man, Adam, was a bit of a gullible prick. So straight out of the gate.
Well, this is it. They did the hard learning so that we don't have to, didn't they? That's the point. And that's, of course, what they should be teaching in religious education instead of topical cartooning, probably. You know, they should be a little bit more emphasis on the lessons of the old books.
I mean, the very first thing that God did in the sort of Christian understanding was a bit sort of smashed windows, wasn't it? Zero tolerance, Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
One strike.
Out.
It's very hard to reconcile yourself to a God like that, but you go, fuck it, you know.
On the other hand, it's kind of in that you had one job kind of territory, isn't it? He literally, the whole garden, you've got all the garden, all of the beasts of the field, fruit hanging, low hanging fruit, you know, you're not being expected to till and plow.
Yeah.
Just don't eat that apple, apple.
If this comes around in a circular way, were they not like the lion in Toby Young's analogy, essentially, in captivity and ultimately destined to live a more risky but fulfilling life?
Yeah, they certainly were. Paradise was an old word for just a walled garden. It was a thing that everyone had, a paradise, And it's true, you know, do you want to live in the walled garden? I think knowing that, there was an American commentator talked about this recently. Paradise is lovely as long as there is a gate in the wall, as long as there is a door and you haven't tested it and it isn't locked, then you can live happily in paradise. As soon as you test the door and you realise it's locked, then it's hard to be at rest, isn't it?
I didn't expect it to end up this philosophical. I did. I mean, for me, it's the most ambitious thing I've done on this podcast is attempting to call back to a point made by Toby Young. Didn't see that coming. As we're on this philosophical bent, as we bring the show towards an end, this is from David Price, a long-term fan of the show and patron. He says, looking forward to Simon this week. Jeff, great guest coming back again. Is it something about his drinking? anyway, can you ask Simon this? How will the universe end? Big crunch, big bounce, big rip, or big freeze?
Ooh,
I'm going to pretend I only understood the last one. I'm guessing the last one means another ice age. The rest of it, fuck knows. You'd have to.
There are two great poems on this, aren't there? Robert Frost, some say the world will end in fire, some in ice. And it's a short poem. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but he says that hate and love can both bring about the terminal condition. In there's a wonderful half-hour YouTube film about how the universe is predicted to actually end, and it certainly is in ice. It certainly is, you know, the gradual heat death of the universe, and that's the most plausible. But what's most striking about it is how soon it happens, how soon the end of any sort of prospect of life happens in terms of the total lifespan of the universe. The whole existence of it starts now, and Earth is basically swallowed up by the sun in the first like 2 minutes of this half hour, you know, and then all the stars go out. It's that really, if you ever want things put into perspective, that is the big perspective that mankind is not really built to cope with.
But so that's the freeze, right? Can you define what's the
crunch? By funny coincidence, I was actually reading T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men earlier today because it came up in something else. You know, this is how the world will end, not with a bang, but a whimper.
Mm.
And that, I think, is accurate. That's what I think he penetrates to the heart of things there. I think it will dwindle to a sort of muffled suffocate. It will be like the end of McMurphy
there'll be one solitary Guardian reader left saying, "Hey, say I told you so." That's what they will ensure that their people live on long enough to just have the smug final word. Okay, that's pretty much the end of this week's podcast. Just a couple of reviews to read out. If you leave 5-star ones, I will read them out. It's not really a fair way of doing it, is it? But it's certainly
it garners my the top of the pile.
It just upgrades a few of the fours, let's be honest. Just discovered this podcast. Refreshing to hear some rational discourse with a decent amount of humour. That's what we're aiming for, decent amounts of humour. Tabasco 2012. The podcast just keeps giving. For Disney Plus was for pedo Hogwarts loving types. Hang on. What the fuck? Disney Plus was for pedo loving. Oh, right, because I said that Disney Plus, I was grateful for Disney Plus. I don't even think that Harry Potter is on Disney Plus. Oh, it reminds me of a joke that I used to have, like a very jonglers-y type joke, Simon, once upon a time, where I used to go, after there'd been quite a few Harry Potter films, I'd say, oh, I'll tell you who is good looking. You know the one that plays Hermione in the Harry Potter films? And then I went, they'd all be like, yeah. I said, well, yeah, I've only seen the first one. And it's great. Great moment to bring all these working class men in.
There is there was a series of celebrity photographs recently where they've basically montaged contemporary photographs with pictures of them when they were younger. So Clint Eastwood with his sort of rawhide self and so on. And one of them was of Hermione, like as she is now, with as she appeared in the first Harry Potter film. And of course, a very attractive young woman now. And she's there with this Hermione. It's like a lovely picture. Like it's almost, she's not quite mother and daughter. It's, I guess, older sister, younger sister. Yeah. But there is also this kind of sense that look at this young girl within her is the.
Yeah. You know, there's a bit of Sacha Distel going on, isn't it? We got one from Singapore, Tom. Here, I listen to Jeff's twerpish procrastinations every week via a secret earbud whilst making love to my wife. Normally, they come in at around 60 to 90 minutes. Really. I was particularly pleased to see the episode was only 39 minutes this week. Heroic stuff in the bedroom there, Tom. This is from Coventry Blue Nose. Witty, not Chris, and the antidote to wokery. Wonderful. From Coventry Blue Nose. Just listening to Jeff's podcast at episode 78. So listening to the back catalogue, obviously, they're always the best way to listen to a topical podcast. And yeah, and also Pete Burton, who recently gave me a 4-star podcast, which I refused to read out and told him on air that I wasn't going to do it. He's deleted that and now made it a 5-star podcast. So
fantastic.
I guess I'm creating my own risk-free environment here. Simon, thanks so much for being on the podcast again. Just before you go, give us the name of your podcast and where people can find it.
It's called Common Sanity, and that's a pun on common sanity, which is a word, a fancy old-fashioned word for breaking bread together, for eating together as a sort of means of, ensuring friendly discourse. Common Sanity. We've only got a couple up so far. We've got about 5 or 6 booked in now, and so gradually they'll emerge, but they're both on YouTube and Spotify. And
there's a Patreon as well.
And the Patreon, which you'll find if you search Patreon for Simon Evans or it's my pinned tweet.
It's so funny how so many of us comedians from whatever the side of this fence this is have done Patreons. Like we're pathologically unable to claim anything from the government. I can't help me, God damn it. I'd rather have hernias.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got to set up a little stall on the seafront selling secondhand books now.
Brilliant. Simon Evans, thanks so much.
Take care, Jeff. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.